The order of their presentation, they are San Antonio State Hospital versus Kimberly Cowan and others from Bexar County and the 4th Appellate District. In the interest of BLD and BRD from McLennan County and the 10th Appellate District. And in the interest of MS, ES, DS, SS, and NS from Jefferson County and the 9th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each matter and will conclude the arguments by the lunch break. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you can purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in San Antonio State Hospital versus County.
May it please the court, Mr. Greg Abbott, Attorney General, will set argument for petitioner.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Abbott, and I represent San Antonio State Hospital in this case, and with the court's permission, I will conduct oral argument from counsel table. Plaintiff sued San Antonio State Hospital under the Tort Claims Act. In doing so, the plaintiffs had to establish three things in order to survive San Antonio State Hospital plea to the jurisdiction. One, that an employee of San Antonio State Hospital used tangible personal property that approximately caused Mr. Cowan's death. In their pleadings, they have shown none of these three things. The first thing that must have been shown is that it was actually an employee of San Antonio State Hospital that caused the death. Here they have not shown that it was an employee. Going back to the court's analysis and the court's formulation, looking at the language of the statute, a governmental unit is liable for personal injury and death so caused by condition or use of tangible personal property. The court has interpreted the so-called provision in the subsection to mean when proximately caused by the negligence or wrongful act or omission of any officer or employee acting within the scope of their employment or office. This court and lower courts have said that liability attaches under subsection 2 for respondeat superior when an employee or officer is negligent. The natural corollary is that only use of property by an employee can trigger a waiver of immunity. In this case, we had no use of property by an employee of the San Antonio State Hospital. It was Mr. Cowan's use of the suspenders and of the piece from the walker that actually caused his death.
How is this different from the athlete's use of a knee brace in low or the, well, I'm trying to think of the right word, the student's use of the swimming paraphernalia without an inner tube in Robinson?
Well, in both Lowe and Robinson, this court has on several occasions constrained those cases to the category of cases of lacking an integral safety component. And this is not one of those cases where property was provided by a state actor that lacked an integral safety component. In this case, of course, all we did, all the hospital did, was to log in the suspenders and return to Mr. Cowan his own property.
So if the whole corpus of the property is unsafe, then it's not a violation of the Tort Claims Act. But if there's one part of the property that's unsafe or is lacking, or it's lacking some characteristic that would make an otherwise unsafe corpus of property safe, then there's tort claims liability. And if that's right, where does that come from the language?
First of all, let me explain that there's a couple of meaningful differences between the concept you're talking about and what we're dealing with in this case. In this case, unlike, say, the life preserver, or unlike the knee brace, it's not as if there was a safety component missing from the suspenders. For one or another, there is no factual allegation that there was a safety component missing from the suspenders. The condition of the suspenders and whether or not they had or did not have an integral safety component is not an issue in this case.
I'll concede that.
All we did was gave back to Mr. Cowan his own suspenders.
But I'm trying to tie this into the language of the statute.
Okay.
How does this distinction that you're drawing, this factual distinction, tie back, relate back to anything the legislature has told us?
Well, what the legislature has told us is that, first of all, liability is to be limited. Secondly, what the legislature has done is to create a special situation that has requirements in order for liability to be waived. First, it must be a state actor. Second, it must be the putting to use of tangible personal property. And three, that the use of that personal property must be the proximate cause of the person's injury or death.
What
we don't have any of those.
What if the property itself is dangerous, is inherently dangerous?
I didn't hear the question.
What if the property itself is inherently dangerous? What would your argument be? What if the hospital employee had given a gun?
It obviously would seem to pose a very interesting situation if a hospital gave a gun to a person who was a patient at a mental facility. But what you do is you go back to the core language of what the statute provides, keeping in mind this isn't a general negligence situation.
But under your argument, even providing a gun to a suicidal patient at a hospital would not qualify for immunity because the employee didn't shoot the patient.
That's exactly correct, and I think that is the outcome when you apply the statutory language to the facts. And let me emphasize one key point. It may seem rather harsh, and in fact, courts in the state of Texas have said that application of the Tort Claims Act does on occasion lead to harsh results. But we need to remember that we have sovereign immunity here. Sovereign immunity is waived only to the extent the legislature has waived it. You have to look at the precise language of the statute to determine the scope of the waiver. And there are three things that must be established by the plaintiff in order to achieve that waiver. The mental state by either the government unit or by the person who is injured does not come into play. Going back to some decisions issued by this court, a mental state or mental condition is not tangible personal property. It would be information. It would be knowledge. If we knew that the person had, let's say, suicidal tendencies, that would be information and knowledge on our part. Information and knowledge on our part, as this court has made clear, is not the use of tangible personal property. Waiver is limited only to those situations where a state actor actually puts to use tangible personal property. In this case, we simply don't have
that. Well, it seems to me it's hard. It's sort of like a distinction without a difference, because if you, the knee brace or the swimsuit without the life preserver, you can call it equipment that lacks an integral safety component, or you can call it inherently dangerous. They seem to be the same thing. So if suspenders are inherently dangerous to a suicidal patient, I don't see where you draw the line in terms of intentional use.
Well, first of all, let's go back and draw a very key distinction between what you're talking about and the facts that we have in this case. What you're talking about would be the hospital providing a gun to a person who is suicidal. We didn't have that here. We don't have, for one, providing a gun, but more importantly, we don't have the other fundamental prerequisite. And that is, the hospital wasn't providing something to Mr. Cowan for Mr. Cowan to use. All the hospital did was to return Mr. Cowan to suspended.
But if it had been the hospital's walker, what difference does that make?
There's no evidence that it was the
hospital. But, I mean, how would this apply in other situations? Would you say if it's his own walker, there is no liability, but if the hospital supplies it, there's liability?
No, I would say even if the hospital supplied a walker to Mr. Cowan, it would not be the hospital's putting to use of property that approximately caused Mr. Cameron's injury. Let me give you an example.
Then Lowe is wrong.
Well, first of all, I think this court has gone out of its way to endeavor to try to limit Lowe and Robinson and the other cases which the court seems to try to subcategorize as cases involving a property that lacks an integral safety component. This is not one of those cases. The court has time after time after time tried to limit and subcategorize those cases. It doesn't fall within those. There's no allegation of lacking an integral safety component. The reason is it wasn't us providing property. Going to Robinson, which is the life preserver case, the state affirmatively took upon itself to get involved and to provide a life preserver to that person. Here we weren't providing our own state property. We were merely returning Mr. Cameron's property. The same thing applies in Lowe, where the state affirmatively got involved to supply a knee brace to Mr. Lowe. Here again, we don't have the situation. We were merely returning the property to Mr. Cannon. But let me give you an example that may help put this in some context. As we sit here today, there are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people incarcerated in the state of Texas. And what we have is, as we speak, the state is providing tangible personal property to all those people who are incarcerated who have a mental state which could not be categorized as the reasonable person in the state of Texas. These are violent people. These are sometimes suicidal people. Nevertheless, we provide them tangible property in the sense of utensils to eat with, beds to sleep on, things with which they can fashion shanks or whatever to injure other people. Are we going to have a situation where every time an inmate in the state of Texas uses some property from the prison to stab somebody else, is that a use of tangible personal property by the state of Texas? Of course not. The original use that is made of the property by the state in that situation and by the hospital in this situation, if it can be categorized as a use, is a benign use. In that situation, is the state providing utensils so inmates can eat with. In this situation, it's a matter of simply returning suspenders to Mr. Cattle. That is a benign use. It was Mr. Cattle.
But doesn't that get into the ultimate liability question? I mean, you still have to, once you establish the tangible property, you still have to establish that it's under a circumstance that somebody would be liable that wasn't the government. So that would come under, it seems to me, just the general liability section once the tangible personal property is used.
I'm not exactly following.
There are two pieces to it. There's the use of tangible personal property, and in order to hold the state liable then, that you've got to prove the liability, that there was negligence. That just goes to the underlying cause of action. Seems like what you're arguing goes to the underlying cause of action. Whether there would ultimately be liability, benign use or non-benign use, would be negligent, not negligent.
Actually, I'm trying to make a little bit different point, and that is this important interpreting and applying the statute to look at the use to which the item is put and who is putting that item to use. In this situation, it was the hospital that was merely returning Mr. Callan's suspenders to it. The hospital was not putting it to use, and maybe this would be helpful if I take a step back and go back over the court's definition of use, which has been used countless times.
But before you do that, you wouldn't think it was different, though, as I understand your argument, if the hospital had given him suspenders and a walker. Or did
you say, I would not think it would be different. If the hospital gave Mr. Callan, he checked in without anything, and the hospital provided a walker and suspenders to Mr. Callan, the result should still be the same. There is no waiver of immunity because the use to which the items were put were to provide, let's say, ambulatory assistance to Mr. Walker.
But so, to be clear, you don't think it makes any difference whether the hospital gave him property back or gave him property in the first instance?
I would agree with that. I do think our case is slightly more compelling, being that we merely returned property to him, because let's look at this on the bigger stage. Is the state, are all governmental units going to be liable every time they merely return someone's property to them? How many times are people arrested every single day where their property is originally confiscated and then they're bailed out or whatever and they return their property and go about their merry way? To commit suicide or harm somebody else as a result of that? Are we going to have an onslaught of claims that claim?
Do you have any judicial opinion or any scholarly work that suggests that a useful limit on use of property would be that the state actor must be using the property?
I'm sure the state actor must be using the property. It would start with, I didn't interpret what this court wrote in the Witt versus Harris County, where the court relied upon Lowe, Salcedo, and York, and said, and I quote, so caused means when proximately caused by the negligence or wrongful act or omission of any officer or employee acting within the scope of his employment or office.
Well, I know that in all these cases, a state actor has touched the property. Lowe, some assistant coach had the knee brace, and Robinson, a worker at the home, had the swimsuit. But Has anyone suggested that at the time the injury is caused, it must be because of use of property that the state actor is using at that time? That is Lowe and Robinson.
I would say the converse is true, and that is I haven't seen any case where the converse is true, where some third person is using the property.
The requirement that a government employee use this property. Let's look at the language of the Tort Claims Act and see if you can point us to where that comes from the language of the statute. 101.021, subsection 1, specifically refers to the negligence of an employee. Subsection 2, which is at issue, subsection 1 is not at issue, does not make any reference to an employee. How can we get to where you are from the language of the statute?
The light has come on, Madam Chairman.
You may finish answering this question.
It comes from two things. One is this court's many interpretations of the two words so caused. If you look back again at subsection 2, it says personal injury and death, quote, so caused. And in DeWitt versus Harris County, the court spoke specifically about what that meant. And said that it meant caused by the negligence or wrongful act of an employee acting within the scope of their employment. And then secondly, on a couple of different occasions, in both DeWitt versus Harris County and in TNRCC versus White, the court said that subsection 1 and subsection 2 are to be interpreted similarly.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument for response.
May I please report, Mr. Alex Miller will present argument for response.
Chief Justice, may I please report? I'm Alex Miller. I'm with the Watts Law Firm here with Sandra Wadis. I'm with Wayne Wright's office. We represent the respondent, the Cowan family, and the plaintiffs below. As Mr. Abbott has pointed out, we're here again before the court on this issue of property, use of property on the Tort Claims Act. Essentially, the way that I see what we have here on the Tort Claims Act is three issues. One is the issue of whether the property actually had a relationship with the injury, and that's the issue that's been coming up in Bosley and then Miller. And then the other issues are whether the employee used the property, and then the third one is whether the employee's use of that property was a proximate cause of the injury. We're clearly dealing with proximate cause as the main issues of liability, but on the pleaded jurisdiction issue, what we're looking at the beginning is whether the property itself had a relationship with this injury, and then also whether the employee was using the property. Those are the things we look at on the pleaded jurisdiction. As a preliminary issue of whether the court has subject matter jurisdiction, we look at those issues. And in this case, well, let me back up. In Bosley, for instance, the court, even though it went on approximate cause determination, it really seemed to be troubled by the fact that in that case, the property that was being brought into question, which was the door and the lock on the door, they did not physically cause the injury. And then the court used approximate cause analysis, and basically that was a summary judgment case, not a plea to jurisdiction, and found that there was essentially no cause in fact between the property itself and the injury, and therefore there was no claim under the Tort Claims Act. And then Justice Abbott wrote a dissent in that opinion saying, let's be careful. We need to be looking at proximate cause in this issue. This is a summary judgment case. It's unusual to find that you actually are reversing on a summary judgment or rendering on a summary judgment based on proximate cause. And I think that case was similar to Lear Siegler, which the court relied on, or Albritton, which I'm not relied on, in that it was very attenuated, so that it was a question whether you had any cause in fact between the use of that property and the injury that was caused in that case. And then the next case that the court, or one of the next cases, the last case maybe that the court had on...
Mr. Miller,
yes,
isn't it easy to reconcile the dissent by Mr. Abbott in a former life with his position now? In Bosley, at issue was a summary judgment. In this case, at issue is a plea to the jurisdiction. So the parties are limited to the facts that were pled in the summary judgment. Obviously, we had to look at evidence. The argument was there was a fact question. So isn't it easy to reconcile that case?
Your Honor, I would think so, but when this court looked in Miller, it looked at a plea to jurisdiction and started looking at the same issues in Miller, on the factual determinations and issues that were brought in outside the record. And even though that was a pleaded jurisdiction review, it actually then started looking, which I think was an improper use, it started looking to issues of whether they proved in that case, in Miller, it was the use of a drug that masked the meningitis. And the court started looking at whether that use had been proved by the plaintiff as a proximate cause and not whether it was just alleged. And so I would agree with you, yes, it should be very distinguishable, but for some reason the court in Miller decided, well, we're going to use a proximate cause analysis. We're going to make sure you prove something as a summary judgment standard, even on a plea to jurisdiction. When you go back and you look at all the cases, I think that one of the main concerns the court has had, and I think rightfully so, is in Miller and in Lowe, Robinson, Clark, all those cases, the property itself didn't physically cause any harm. And so the court was always having to struggle determining, can we just use plain proximate cause here, just a one-time proximate cause issue, and resolve that. And if you look at it just on the basic proximate cause issue, it's almost always going to raise a fact issue, which means you can't decide it on plea to jurisdiction. It's always going to go to the end until you have a jury determination, and therefore the government's going to be sued more than this court wanted it to, and more than the legislature likely wanted it to, because if we have to use just one proximate cause analysis for the whole thing, it may not be the legislative intent, although I don't see how we could ever figure legislative intent from this statute.
Well, let me ask you this. If we fashion... Let me propose a rule that said we're going to require affirmative employee use except for property that lacks an integral safety component. Would that comport with our jurisprudence thus far?
I think that would be consistent with what the court has said thus far.
Okay, if that's the case, then what happens here is we don't have property that lacks an integral safety component, and we don't have... I guess what I'm asking is, would Mr. Abbott's position be square with our law if that's the way we interpret it to read?
I don't believe so because I think that there's no question that there was a use of property in this case. What Mr. Abbott is saying is that the employee of the state used the property for one purpose, and it caused an injury that he doesn't believe is foreseeable. And because there was this third party in between, he thinks that if there was new and independent cause or something of that nature, and as I believe you said earlier, isn't that go to the ultimate proximate cause issue of the case?
Walking me through this, from your perspective, do you think that the Tort Claims Act waives sovereign immunity in this case because the state employee actually touched the property? Allen's property, because he touched the suspenders, and the suspenders caused injury, the Tort Claims Act is what?
No, Your Honor. I would say that the state used the property. They provided it to him.
Now, when you say provided to him, he checks in this facility in a suicide watch. All the doctors in the world say you should have taken the suspenders away from him. They were open and obvious. You should have taken them away from him. You would say that the Tort Claims Act in those circumstances is not waived because the employee did not touch the suspenders. See what I'm saying? Am I being clear?
Yes, I believe so. Let me use an example, which I think may answer it. When we walk in the door here, the security guard, the metal detector, if I had a gun in my bag, they looked at it, they found the gun, they saw it, they put it back in and sent me through. They had control of it, they had custody of it, they gave it back to me, and I think in circumstances we are, not me personally, but that would cause a foreseeable risk. If he did not find it, if there was something there, if he didn't see it, he didn't have any control.
My argument is that he does see it. My argument is he doesn't touch it. He does see it. He doesn't touch it. And your evidence is, well, he should have touched it. He should have taken it. Is that the distinction you see here?
Well, I don't think it has to be a distinction in our case, but let me address it. I think that it creates an interesting issue, most especially in an involuntary commitment that we have. Because he was being committed to the state for a suicide watch, and part of what that is for is so they do take custody and control of not only his body but everything he has to make sure he doesn't have anything that he could use to hurt himself.
So now, you would argue that the state provided the suspenders even if the employee had not touched the suspenders?
I think in this particular circumstance that would have happened even in this case, even if they had just seen them and provided them to him. I think it would be essentially implicit in the relationship that they had with him because he was involuntarily committed. I don't think we have to get to that.
Judge Abbott is clearly right, General Abbott is clearly right that any time a prisoner injured another prisoner with some property that the state had provided or allowed the prisoner to use, there would be court claim waiver.
If they provided the property, then yes, Your Honor, if there was a causal relationship between the property, and that's what you're saying, then yes, there would be a waiver. Now, there may not be any liability because it may not have been foreseeable, but there would be a waiver of the Tort Claims Act in that situation because I believe what the Tort Claims Act, the struggle is what is the extra thing that the Tort Claims Act means by saying use of property? And I think that what it means is the property itself has to be the instrumentality of the harm itself. Property has to be the instrument of harm. And that's where the struggle has come up in so many of these cases, but we don't have that issue in this case because the instrument of harm was the property that we're talking about.
So if the hospital had not touched the walker or the suspenders, your case would
Again, because of the unusual circumstances we have with an involuntary commitment and what they have in this case, I'm not sure that that would be true, but I don't think we have to get to that point in this case because we're here on a plea to the jurisdiction in which we have alleged that they did have custody and control of the property and they put it to a use.
Well, but you want us to say that that's required and that means something, but your position would be you wouldn't take that position if the orderly had not checked in, logged in the walker and suspenders, or would you?
To be honest, Your Honor, I hadn't particularly thought about it that much, and I apologize. I don't know. I think it creates a much more difficult question of whether they actually use the property. And like I said, in this case, we've alleged that they did use it, we alleged that they did control it, and I believe the facts will prove that they did take custody and control of it and then gave it to him. And I do think that the state does this on a regular basis where they do take control of it.
But your point is that the tangible property that you use doesn't have to be owned by the state. In Robinson and Lowe, it was the state property that got used in this municipal part. But your point for the Tort Claims Act to be waived under these facts that you allege, your point is it doesn't have to be the state's property that gets used. It could be any property that gets used, so long as the state had some responsibility for it. In this case, I'm checking someone into the hospital, it's a suicide watch, it's an involuntary commitment, I see the suspenders, I see the walker, I don't touch them. So long as you have evidence that said a reasonable person under those circumstances, a reasonable hospital under certain circumstances, should have taken control of the property, you would get there under the Tort Claims Act because there was a state action that should have been required that they didn't do and that permitted the tangible property to remain in the possession of
I'm not sure that I would agree with that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is they had to have had custody and control. They did have custody and control. So the distinction being, if you went into, for instance, University Hospital, which is just a normal hospital that's run by the state, and somebody brings their own property in, they don't have control over that. But what I'm saying is that the distinction between the hypothetical you gave is that they did have custody and control over it, and whether that's implicit because of the involuntary commitment and what the state did in putting them in there and the very specific circumstances of this case, then that's what I'm talking about is a legal distinction of they have custody and control because of the circumstance. So if they never had custody and control of it, and it's not the state's property, then I don't think the Tort Claims Act would apply because I do think that it has to be a relationship of the employee using the property.
Suppose he'd come in on crutches and they didn't take his crutches away from him. And he went, they put him in a room, and he shredded his own shirt and used part of the crutch. Much as he used the piece of the walker, would you still be making the same argument?
We'd be making the same argument. I think, of course, feasibility would be a more difficult issue, but I do think we'd make the same argument under the pleaded jurisdiction of use of property, and if they used that property and that property was the intentionality of harm, and that's what caused the injury, then it was used, and it was used by an employee to put it into use, and some use, and when we go back to the statute as it previously read before it was codified as it is now, talked about some use, not a use for a particular, for its own inherent purpose.
How do you interpret the phrase so called? Do you see that as requiring some employee use of the property itself?
I think that it does, because I think that you have to have the state action at some point. And I would tend to agree with the court where it said before that, based on the way the statute read before, it was clearer that it didn't, when it was talking about so cause, it was talking about the cause being used by an employee. But again, previous statute also said so caused by some property or some use. I'm sorry, some condition or some use. And I don't think that what the statute was talking about then and what it means now is that it has to be used in any specific type of property for any specific type of purpose, as long as there's property involved. But I do think that so caused, the causal relationship at that point refers back to the employee. And I do think there's proximate cause with the employee, and there has to be. But the proximate cause with the employee is not going to be an issue for this pleaded jurisdiction, because we've alleged it as the proximate cause in the pleaded jurisdiction at this point, because there was no evidence put on it. I don't know if it really should be the proper issue for any evidence anyway under the plan. That is not one of the issues that's being brought up, really, approximate cause, the foreseeability, whether they should have foreseen this or not. The issues really at this point are whether the property was the cause of the harm, which there's no question it is in this case, as opposed to Lowe, where it's actually the property didn't cause the harm, it was the other football player.
Let me ask you this. I think you answered my question earlier that the general's position of the way he put it is, you've either got to have property that lacks an integral safety component, which we don't have here, or you have to have employee use of the property. And I believe you said that is not inconsistent with our jurisprudence. Why shouldn't we adopt that rule if, in fact, the tort claims waiver was intended to be limited?
I'm not saying that is not inconsistent with what the court's been holding, but I don't know.
I guess what I'm asking is the condition of a property and an
employee's use of the property. And what you're saying is, even if the employee didn't use it, it had a certain condition.
No. My understanding of the rule he's proposing is either you have to have affirmative employee use of property, which we don't have here.
I agree that you have to have employee use. What I'm saying is the employee has to put it to a use. And once the employee puts it to a use, the employee doesn't have to sit there and strangle somebody with it. It doesn't have to be direct and immediate causation. It has to be proximate cause. The employee's use is proximate cause. As Justice Jefferson referred to, the Tort Claims Act says so caused. It means the injury is so caused by the employee through a use of property.
Well, what if he had brought in sleeping pills or some sort of drug that could kill him if he'd taken too much, and the employee simply failed to find them on his person, and he went in and took the pills? I mean, he's using tangible personal property. Is that use within the Tort Claims Act?
If they had custody and control over it, then that is the issue for the Tort Claims Act, is whether the employee had custody control and then used the property for some purpose. I don't know that you would say that the employee used that at any point, because I don't know if the employee got it. You say they never saw it, they had no idea. I don't know if you can say that the employee used it when they had no idea about it. If you do have some legal issue of you were deemed to have had custody of everything, you're deemed to have put it to use if they used it because you had custody of him, then yes, it would be. But I think that creates a different situation. And again, I think that'd be difficult on proximate cause when you did get to the ultimate case.
Mr. Miller, where are you saying the use occurred here? Are you saying it occurred at the time that this personal property was used, the strangulation, or are you saying it was used at the time the state, and I'll assume your interpretation of the facts the state had possession and control over it and issued it or returned it to him. When do you say the use occurred?
The use occurred when the state provided it to him.
Okay, so if you say that, then you are not saying that the use occurred when the injured person, pretty good injuries, when he used them to wrap it around his neck or whatever he did to kill himself.
No, Your Honor, that is not the event that the jury would be asked a question about. The incident the jury is asked a question about.
I understand.
The initial use.
Clarify that. It's not the victim's use here. It's the state's use.
Yes, Your Honor. And the state will likely raise that as a intervening cause. And they can get it. That's not an affirmative defense, but it is a defense on comparative analysis, and they can raise that at the time of trial.
Let me ask you this. Just looking at the statute, and if we can, forgetting the whole history, Lowe and Robinson and Miller, et cetera. If you just read the statute, would you say that there are two reasonable constructions of the statute? One that says it must be the employee of the hospital or of the state that used the property, and another that says, no, it could be the victim of the property, as in this case, having been provided property.
My time is up, may I go ahead? I don't think that the statute is as clear as it could or should be. I think that's what the court has asked the legislature on numerous occasions to go back and clarify. So I don't think it is entirely clear.
So nothing in the statute compels either reversal or affirmance. In the statute itself, I'm saying, without prior instruction, we just have to make a choice. We just have to make a choice.
I would say yes, although I think you use some types of statutory construction. Again, this is a difficult situation because of the history, and because I think the court started using legislative history very early on because it's such a large topic of government at the time, and that I think the court's gotten very far into the legislative history. And so I don't think the statute is clear, but I have trouble with that because I hate to say, well, the statute isn't clear, and therefore, because it's not a clear waiver of liability, the legislator didn't intend to waive any liability, and I wouldn't go that far because I don't think that's the intent of the legislator. I think they did intend to waive liability. I think they intended to waive it when you could prove that the property itself was an instrumentality of harm, and then you have the other issues on the proximate causation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
As this court has noted, merely alleging the property was involved is simply not enough. If only involvement were required, the waiver of immunity would be virtually unlimited, since few injuries do not somehow involve the use of tangible personal property.
If this were not a government entity, if this were a private hospital, would there be liability here?
Your Honor, there could very well, and that's the important issue to keep in mind, and that is that there are many instances where just pure negligence, for example, absence of medical judgment, can lead to liability on the part of a private person. But when it comes to a governmental entity, the only way in which a government unit can be held
but if it's a private entity, if it's not a governmental entity, what would the negligence claim look like here? The causative thing would be the property. I mean, you'd say that they negligently provided inherently dangerous property. And why does that property distinction in the private context not get us there here when subsection 2 of the statute talks about liability if it would attach in a non-governmental unit context?
Well, several things. First of all, when I was addressing the question, I was talking about globally a private person can be held liable for situations which a government unit cannot. On the facts of this case, where you have merely a situation of somebody returning property to somebody else, I'm not sure if it would get there under general negligence principles. But the point is that general negligence principles don't apply here. What applies here are the three prerequisites set out by the Tort Claims Act. It has to be an employee putting to use tangible personal property that causes the death. Here, we don't have a situation where property was put to use. Let me refer back if I can to a different case.
Let's explore that. As you know, well know that we struggle with this. What if that should mean what if at a concession, state concession stand, over in the Capitol or a park or somewhere else, the state sold a tangible personal property, a soft drink, a hot dog, a lighter without a child-proof thing that was a defective product, and a person who's not a state employee purchased it and was injured in the use of it. Would the Tort Claims Act apply to that or not?
I happen to believe it would not, because the use to which the item was put, we'll say, whichever one you want to choose, it wasn't that use that caused the problem. And let me make clear along those lines, that is, the statute is not intended to encompass situations such as inherently dangerous products, which kind of goes back to a question that you asked earlier on. The statute doesn't address it. The statute only concerns the actual putting to use of tangible personal property. And let's refer back to below, if we could. That was a situation where the girl hurt her head on a bus. And as the court made clear, even though it involved the tangible property of the bus being involved, that wasn't sufficient to trigger the use of the property provision, because it was merely the situs where the injury occurred. Here, it wasn't the returning of the suspended.
Well, we've got the same language, use of real property, and that's typically real property that's got a defective, and someone's injured, that's the situs, and you can recover under the Tort Claims Act for use of real property. How do you square that?
Well, you're talking about like a condition of real property,
yes.
Or?
Just condition or use of tangible, personal, or real property.
Okay. It would, again, it's the use to which the property is put, and whether or not that use causes the injury to the third party. Here we have merely a benign use that did not cause Mr. Cowan's injury. And if I could, let me go back one more time to the example, because if the court were to determine that in this particular instance, and first of all, Your Honor, if I may, can I finish answering the question? I realize it's been long. If the court determines that merely returning property to somebody else, or even taking a step further, let's say the hospital affirmatively decided to give these suspenders to Mr. Cowan, if the court determines that that is a use of tangible personal property, the scope of the Tort Claims Act has suddenly got immensely bigger. Consider the prison situation. Consider the multitude of situations where the state government provides tangible property to people who work for the state government, who then may in turn use that property to either commit suicide or harm somebody else. It wasn't the providing, the original providing of tangible personal property to the government employee or to the third person that caused the injury. It was that third person then taking that property and using it for a different purpose that caused the injury.
Any other questions?
Does the Attorney General share the view that this use or condition of personal property is so opaque that after 30 years, judicial efforts to construe it are at best metaphysical and at worst nonsense?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then, having called upon the legislature to clarify this to no avail, does the Attorney General think that that would be a good thing for them to vote their efforts so much?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that their belief is that the reduction in budget will reduce tangible
property to some extent. If those ideas are so good, how come you never enjoy it? I mean, any other questions? Thank you. We'll close the argument with the first cause, and we'll take a brief recess.
All right.